Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, my hometown, out there on the prairies. It's been beautiful this last week. The Lake Wobegon Whippets opened their 94 home season with the annual Memorial Day doubleheader at the Wally Old Hard Hands Bunsen Memorial Park against the Avon Bards. Ernie the Old Knuckleballer was up on the mound for the first game. He was a little over-anxious, throwing a little bit hard, but he discovered a secret. He'd get that knuckleball to flutter the way he wanted if he put a stone in his right shoe. Somehow that just did the trick. It brought him down off the mound, off balance, and that was all that he needed. Unfortunately, he didn't discover that until the seventh inning, and by that time, we were on the short end of a 10-1 score. Chip Soderberg was up, the big sidewind left-hander, was up for the second game for the hometown team. He pitched shutout ball right up through the sixth inning when a woman in a white dress who had been sitting directly behind home plate got up and left with a guy who'd just driven in a red Camaro. And this disturbed Chip's concentration, so he had to leave the mound at that point, and he was relieved by Ernie, the Old Knuckleballer, and this time the stone in the shoe did not work for Ernie, and we came out with a score of Whippets 2 and the Bards 11. But, as we say in Lake Wobegon, it could have been worse. And it was a beautiful day out there in the sun, despite the paint fumes from the bleachers, leaving some people a little bit lightheaded. But it's that time of year. It was warm and sunny this last week, and it put all of the 1994 graduates of Lake Wobegon High School who are going to graduate on Wednesday, put them into a warm and a wistful mood, thinking about their futures. Those hopeful young people who are going to be parading up to get their diplomas out on the football field on Wednesday evening. The platform is set up in the end zone, and a lot of these young men in the graduating class have never crossed the goal line before. So that'll be exciting for them. Tonight is a great occasion for me, and I hope you forgive me if I talk about it, because it was 20 years ago this spring that I came down here to the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville to write a magazine piece about the Grand Ole Opry on its last night from this hall before it moved out to Opryland. And that Friday night at the Opry in 1974 is very vivid to me. I remember where I was sitting. I was right up there in the balcony. I can almost see the seat from here. And it was sitting up there in the balcony, looking down here at all of them playing on the show, that made me think that if I ever managed to finish writing this piece, I'd like to go back up to Minnesota and start a radio show just like the Grand Ole Opry. It seemed like a lot of fun. So it's a powerful feeling to come and visit the site of yet another of life's haphazard decisions. And to think about who that young man was sitting up there in the balcony. He was 32 years old. He was discontented and confused, normal for a writer. And he was sitting up there looking at people on the stage trying to think how he was ever going to get this down on paper. It was just too glorious and too exotic. The pulsation of fans, people fanning themselves in this auditorium, those church windows in the back, the colors of the sequins and the way the performers did their hair, the way the announcer gestured to the audience for applause, the crowd milling around in the wings, those pin rails along the wings with the ropes tied to them going on up to the fly gallery, all those performers coming on with their gorgeous mother-of-pearl guitars and the smell of hot dogs and beer and the smell of people, all of that gaiety and confusion. I was sitting up there and wondering how I was ever going to write this thing. It was my first nonfiction piece of writing, and I was really on the spot. I wasn't that smart, but I'd known that for a long time. Ever since I almost got kicked out of the University of Minnesota, where I came to the limits of my natural God-given ability at taking multiple choice tests. I had perfect pitch when it came to multiple choice. Somehow I could always hear which one was the right answer. And in the Midwest, back in the 1950s, it was almost always C was the correct answer. So I coasted along on that for a long time until I got to the university and you had to take essay tests. You had to actually write about things. And that threw me for a loop. And I sort of made it on fiction for a while, but I was here at the Opry back in 1974 trying to think about how I was going to write this. And I thought to myself, you know, that looks like fun down there on stage, what they're doing, singing and entertaining these wonderful people. Wouldn't that be a great way to spend your time? And so I went back to Minnesota in the spring of 74, and we started up a Prairie Home Companion. That was 20 years ago, all the result of a foolish decision made in the balcony of this auditorium way back then. That young man, of course, had no idea what he was doing, but that was good because he had bad judgment to begin with. So if he'd made a considered decision, he would have done the wrong thing. Some kind of loose impulse was the only way for him to rescue himself from his ambitions, which were frustrating him. He wanted to write short fiction, and he was writing short fiction about vaguely unhappy, overeducated people who sit at home and think long thoughts and open their refrigerator door and see a wilted head of lettuce in there, and it speaks to them of mutability and change, mortality and death, and they call up a friend and they talk about it for 3 or 4 pages. Somehow he needed to be pulled away from this gloom and this self-pity. And radio, of course, was the way to pull yourself away from, because nobody would ever sit and listen to self-pity at great length. I don't think so. So it sort of forces you back on assets that you were trying to rid yourself of. Like somebody who wanted to go into gold mining, but as it doesn't turn out, so they enter into a career of well digging instead. He had to fall back on this little town, which was all he knew about. And so that little town came into being. Little town beside a lake out on the prairie in Minnesota, and some grain elevators rising up beside it. Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility Church up there on the hill, and the statue of the unknown Norwegian down there on Main Street. A little beach there behind Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery where an old dog named Bruno wades in water up to his armpits and looking for a great fish, like the fish that he caught in his jaws when he was young. It's just down that beach is the dock going out into the lake, where Wally's pontoon boat was tied up when the 28 Lutheran pastors got off the bus. And they went and they got onto that 20-foot pontoon boat. Pastor Inquist was the last one aboard. And as the other 28 were all on, he saw the level of the deck briefly go below the surface of the water and then come back up. He thought about warning them, but he didn't want to alarm anybody. He thought about just pushing the boat away with his foot, but he did the Christian thing. He got on the boat, and Wally gunned the 16-horsepower engine, and it slowly planed away out onto the lake. And to people who were watching from downtown, this seemed like a miracle from the Gospels. In the Gospels, only our Lord did it, but here there were 28 standing and moving slowly across the surface of the water. And they would have been all right, except they hit just a slight wave, and some of them moved towards the rear, and there wasn't quite room, and the boat tipped back, and the barbecue grill. Did I mention the barbecue grill? It was up in the bow. And it started to tip towards them. And Pastor Enquist went to catch it, and then he thought better of it. It spilled red, hot, flaming coals on the deck of that pontoon boat. It was like a vision out of the book of the Revelations. And they moved to the stern, and they stepped off into water that came up to about their upper lips and stood looking up at the sky, trying to call for help. But they had pastoral voices. Their voices were trained to give help, not to express alarm. They called, "Help! Help!" Till a child who was standing in water about 20 feet away, water up to her waist, said, "Over here." And they waded it out. That's my little town. It's a town where nobody uses turn signals because everybody knows which way you're going to go anyway. It's a town where you have to learn to laugh at yourself because other people may not have time to. It's just, you have to deal with life yourself in that small town. The bride has to sing at her own wedding sometimes. Sometimes the groom has to hold his own shotgun. It's a town where there's nobody else to wash your clothes for you. You have to do it for yourself. And so everybody in town has seen your underwear. Many times. They've seen it on the line. They know what your underwear looks like. And they have heard you snoring. And if you have a taste for whiskey, they know what kind and they know to what extent. And when you kneel down in church on Sunday morning to ask the Lord's forgiveness, the people around you have a pretty good idea which sins you are thinking of. And they have an idea which ones you may be forgetting. And they see you there and they think to themselves, "You know, I really like the shoes he wore last week a lot better than those." They keep a close watch on you in that little town. But it's a great place for an overly ambitious young man to be from and to talk about, because it does save you from your quest to be the best, which is a great relief in life. People all over the country are angry at themselves for not being smart enough or skinny enough or rich enough or sexy enough. But in Lake Wobegon, they gave up on that a long time ago. We failed a long time ago, and that's a blessing. Lake Wobegon will never be the Athens of the Midwest. It never hoped to. We knew we weren't Athenians. We knew it was beyond us to even try. It never will be the jewel of Mist County. It never will be the queen city of the upper Mississippi River Valley. It's a place where people believe in the idea of things being good enough, as we say back home. It could be worse. Sometimes things are just good enough. Sometimes your children are good enough. Sometimes you live in a town. It's good enough to live in. It's good enough for you. And once you recognize that idea of things being good enough, then you can be happy. And people in Lake Wobegon are pretty happy, comparatively. They could be worse. They're good enough. It's a good place to go to learn things that you knew a long time ago. To learn that work is a privilege as well as a necessity. And if you do your job well, no matter what it is, you can look anybody in the eye. That we make our own opportunities, but that no matter who we are, each of us will have our share of sorrow. We can't outsmart life. We can't avoid it. Each of us will have our share and a little bit more. But when we come to the end and to the last judgment, we're all equal and all naked together before God. All of us, without exception. And so, because that day comes quickly, we want to enjoy what is truly best. And that is fresh sweet corn and good coffee, rhubarb pie, new jokes, and people who, even though they know you awfully well, they still vote for acquittal. Thank you so much. That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong and all the men are good looking. And all the children be above average.